the studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Last month, the German multinational drug giant Bayer announced that it would pull its medical device called Esure off the U.S. market. For tens of thousands of women that have had complications from the device, this was welcome, if long overdue, news. Esure and its consequences, along with several other FDA-cleared medical devices, are featured in a new Netflix original documentary called The Bleeding Edge, directed by Kirby Dick and produced by my guest today, Amy Hurdy. Hurdy and Dick have worked on several documentaries together, including The Hunting Ground, about rape on college campuses, and The Invisible War, a documentary about rape in the U.S. military. Hurdy was previously an investigative reporter with the Denver Post before becoming the author of a book and moving into documentary film production. She spoke with me from her home in Washington State. Amy Hurdy, producer of the new Netflix documentary The Bleeding Edge, about the dangers of the medical device industry in the United States, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Amy Hurdy, welcome to Medical Monday. I want to start, well, first of all, I congratulate you on the film, The Bleeding Edge, the new Netflix documentary on the medical device industry. And the film tackles really four specific devices. And I think it's safe to say the biggest one and the biggest success to date, I guess, from the film is Esure. So tell us about Esure, what this device is and the problems that it causes.
Esure, birth control sterilization technique, is a device that is implanted into a woman's fallopian tube, one device per tube, and it's supposed to cause scarring, which creates a barrier between any potential egg and sperm, so therefore it blocks conception. So the problem with Esure is that it started having creating adverse events almost from the get-go, and they didn't study it long enough. Bayer didn't study it. They had their initial approval study. It was non-blinded. They didn't have a control group. It was only for 18 months for a device that's supposed to be in place for a woman's lifetime. So women started having adverse reactions almost from the very beginning.
What kinds of adverse reactions do women have with Esure?
Oh, it ranges from pain to excessive bleeding to, you know, autoimmune disorders. They have rashes. It starts causing dental problems. You know, women have become pregnant and miscarried from Esure. There's a whole host of really, truly horrible events.
So it's designed as a permanent sterilization procedure. And of course, it's advertised as being both 99% effective and also being safe and non-surgical. That is, it goes in through the uterus, so there's no incision made in a woman's abdomen. But what I found really surprising was that there was a pretty high failure rate. There were a lot of women getting pregnant on this, let alone all the side effects that the documentary shows in evidence.
Yes, there have been, you know, hundreds of failed pregnancies due to Esure, and that's a number that Bayer certainly disputed, but the FDA database that holds those events called MAUDE doesn't lie, and that's Bayer's own data, so hundreds of those, and it's tragic.
Perhaps even arguably, I guess, in the tens of thousands of women who have formed support groups and Facebook groups in many countries have really come together to fight the firm that makes this, Bayer, and to lobby Congress because they felt like they were getting nowhere with the FDA. Where was the FDA on this product?
Well, the FDA defers to the manufacturers because the FDA is funded in large part by industry. And so they have this cozy relationship with industry that they don't want to disrupt. So the strongest action that the FDA did with Esure was they issued a black box warning. And then they also put some restrictions on the sales of Esure, saying that surgeons had to have a conversation with their patient listing all of the side effects before they implanted it. They didn't go so far as to demand that Bayer take it off the shelves, which is what they should have done. And the group that started this whole movement, it was truly started by one woman named Angie Firmolino, and she's in The Bleeding Edge, and she's phenomenal. And she started this Facebook page. Angie started this Facebook page simply to warn her friends and family, and then it grew from there, from just a handful of people to tens of thousands of members all over the world. And it's amazing the pressure that they put upon Bayer.
Now, Bayer took the product off the market in Europe because from what I gleaned from the documentary, the FDA equivalent in Europe was a little bit stronger or stricter in its interpretation of these adverse outcomes. But even still, then the US FDA was really only left on the market in the United States until Angie and her colleagues went to Congress, and you have some footage of that with them lobbying several congresswomen in particular, but congresspeople, to get a meeting, a face-to-face meeting with Scott Gottlieb, the director of, or the commissioner of the FDA. And it was at that point, only at that point, 2 months afterward, that the black box warning was issued. So why do you think, I mean, was Assure successful? I mean, that's the part of the film I don't get a sense of. Are there satisfied customers with Assure, or is this because their stock line was the benefits outweigh the risks?
Their stock line was that the benefits did outweigh the risk. And I just wanted to correct you on one thing, that the FDA issued a black box warning on Assure months before that. The adjustment that the FDA made was 2 months before the film came out. They came out with their restriction on the sales of Assure, where doctors had to read the warnings to the patients before they were implanted with it. And that was what the FDA did 2 months before the film came out. And then 1 week before the film came out, Bayer made the announcement they were going to be pulling it off the shelves at the end of 2018. But Bayer falsely marketed Assure as effective and safe and misled tens of thousands of women who did not have the ample warnings about the potential complications before they got the device implanted inside their body.
Yeah, and we've talked about some of the adverse effects, and so many women do wind up having repeat surgeries to have the Assure removed, or in some cases to have hysterectomies because of the complications from this procedure. So doing something with this medical device to avoid a surgical procedure often winds up in multiple procedures when there are adverse effects.
Exactly. Another one of the subjects in our film, Anna, had to have a hysterectomy to get the Assure devices out of her body, and she started having complications from having a hysterectomy. Ever since her hysterectomy, she's had a series of urinary tract infections, and one of them recently led to a kidney infection, which put her in the hospital. She just got out of the hospital a few days ago. So it creates this cascade of health problems that these women undergo, some for years, and some have been ever since they've had Assure implanted in their body.
Another product that you focus on in the film, and you have really interesting interview footage, and then I guess he's giving a talk at a sort of a national meeting, is Dr. Stephen Tower, who is an orthopedic surgeon. And I learned about him in one of your film subjects, Gene Lenzer, who wrote a book called The Danger Within Us about the medical device industry, and so her subtitle, The Shocking Truth About Medical Devices. So in particular, these were specialized hip products, that hip replacement products. So essentially artificial hips that had the metallic element cobalt in them. You know, so this is a surgeon who knows pretty much everything about hip replacements, how to do the surgery, about the equipment, and he certainly had done his homework. So he, when he had his own arthritis, because he was an avid active athlete in Alaska, he wound up getting this cobalt hip because he, I guess at the time, I think it was relatively new on the market maybe, and he didn't know much about any adverse events. And so he wound up really decompensating. I mean, he was eventually unable to exercise. He eventually had problems thinking and essentially sort of didn't know, I guess, where he was, or he trashed a hotel room, which was incredibly atypical. So he had sort of a psychiatric breakdown. Yeah. And had to have surgery to have this thing removed. And then once he did, he got dramatically better in a short time. So what was the story with the cobalt hips? I mean, this was something where, and this gets to the whole, I think, one of the problems with the approval process, which is that normally, I mean, devices have only essentially needed FDA approval, I guess, since 1976, unlike pharmaceuticals, which goes back a further ways into the early 60s. But there's this loophole, and as I learned in the film, the exception has become the rule, the 510K loophole, which essentially says, and you can help me on this, but if a device is sort of just a small variation or essentially like its parent device, then it's okay to be just approved without going through a full approval process. Do I have that sort of accurate?
You do, exactly. And approximately 98% of medical devices are approved through the 510K. They do not undergo a single human clinical trial. And people need to know that most of the time, the majority of the time, the medical devices that are used in them or on them have never been used in a human before. And so the patient essentially becomes the guinea pig.
And that's what's so shocking, is 98% of devices that are approved are under this pathway. And so, as the film points out, sometimes the parent device could be off the market, whereas a sibling or cousin or related device may stay on the market and still be causing some harm. Were cobalt products that way? I mean, just as an offshoot
cobalt,
of something?
You know, metal on metal is such a debacle. They knew, manufacturers knew that metal on metal was going to be a problem before they put their HIP products on the market, and they did so anyway because there was enormous competition. They were thought to be more durable. And so for people like Dr. Tower, who was an athlete, they were thought to have greater durability. And so they had studies, and they had internal studies that told them over and over again that these metal particles that were released by the implants were wreaking havoc inside people's bodies, you know, systemic cobalt poisoning. You know, that can cause a whole range of problems, from dizziness to forgetfulness to symptoms that resemble early onset dementia to tremors. You know, enormous cobalt poisoning can, you know, high levels of cobalt poisoning can cause deafness, can cause problems with vision. It goes on and on. And so Dr. Tower was an orthopedic surgeon, and he did his research, and he thought that the cobalt-containing hip replacement device that he was getting inside his body was safe. And even this doctor wasn't safe. So he got the device put in. He immediately started experiencing these really horrible symptoms, and it didn't take him very long to figure out what was causing it. And even while he was having this complete psychological break, he was able to put the pieces together and figure out that his own hip was poisoning him. He was still drawing his own blood. He was still testing it for the cobalt levels. And he finally got the implant taken out and had a dramatic recovery.
And he now, it seems like, spends a lot of his time calling for more research and talking to other physicians about the potential dangers of these products, or really spreading the word. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Amy Hurdy, who is the producer of a new Netflix documentary called The Bleeding Edge, on the medical device industry and some of the problems therein, where these devices are put on the market and approved by the FDA through a number of different means, and in many cases cause harm because they haven't been studied long enough or in significant enough numbers of patients. Amy Hurdy, one of the products that is featured in the film was pretty frightening, mesh, surgical mesh. And this is something, I guess, in the film, at least, I suppose there are probably multiple manufacturers, but the one you talk about is Johnson & Johnson. And this mesh costs very little to make, but winds up costing hospitals or, you know, as things are often inflated in medical care, thousands of dollars. But the cost aside, it winds up really causing adhesions or scarring in patients. What is mesh used for, and how is it so problematic?
So first, I'm going to go back and illuminate something that almost no one realizes, that medical devices are not typically FDA approved. They are FDA cleared. And that distinction is very important, because FDA approved means that it's gone through clinical studies involving humans. FDA cleared means that the FDA said, okay, this device is going to be cleared for marketing. In other words, they say to the manufacturer, we think that it's substantially equivalent enough to a predecessor device, and you can go ahead and put it out in the market, sell it to people, and let's see how it does. That's how most devices are put on the market. And so people need to understand that when they go to the doctor. I went to a chiropractor just recently and got laser on a hamstring. And the chiropractor was telling me, oh, this is such a wonderful device, and the laser, it works phenomenally well, and it's FDA approved. And I said, it's FDA cleared. And he said, no, it's FDA approved. And I said, no, it's cleared. And he didn't know. He didn't understand the difference. So even the doctors themselves often do not know. Now, regarding mesh, transvaginal mesh began when doctors were doing hernia surgeries and using mesh to support tissue for hernia patients. And they realized that they could use the same type of material for women who needed support with their pelvic organs. Often women, I think it's half the population of women who are over the age of 50, experience some type of pelvic organ prolapse or urinary stress incontinence. It's typically linked to childbirth. And so the surgeons were using pieces of mesh, cutting them out, pieces of hernia mesh, and implanting them in the woman to use as, like, classically a hammock to help support these organs. And manufacturers started selling mesh as transvaginal mesh for that purpose. And the problem is that it wasn't given the human clinical trials. And they knew from their own studies that it was going to cause pain, that it was going to harden into these masses inside the woman's body, that it would become entrenched in their tissues, like bubblegum in your hair or like rebar in concrete, and make it nearly impossible to be removed. You know, a woman's reproductive organs, those tissues, are very sensitive, and the mesh just became this lump of hardened plastic that couldn't be removed, and the results were life-altering and simply horrific for so many women.
You have many subjects in the film who talk about their experiences with mesh and how disastrous it's been for one thing, chronic pain, ongoing symptoms, bleeding, infections, but also intimacy with their partners because of sort of their loss of desire or the physical pain that it presents, both to themselves and to their partners in many cases.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, bless her heart, there is one of the subjects in our film, Tammy Jackson, and her husband, Byron, were so brave, and they were talking about their sex life and what mesh had done to their sex life. And it's so sad. I mean, it presents like a little bit of humor in the film because people laugh uncomfortably during that part, but it's truly sad what it's done to them. And what mesh has continued to do to Tammy, for example, was she has had infection after infection after infection. Her body has become antibiotic resistant, and now her kidneys are starting to shut down. And so she has only 25% function in one kidney and 55% function in the other, and she's going to end up on a kidney transplant list. It's going to be because of mesh.
Wow. Yeah, your story of the mesh reminds us about how when the FDA approves a medication or, as you taught me, clears a device to go on the market, once it's on the market, a doctor or a healthcare provider can then use it as he or she sees fit. In other words, it's released with a certain indication, but then you can do off-label prescribing if in the case of medication or like with this hernia mesh used for other purposes, and then it can sometimes be rebranded or remarketed for different purposes. One thing the movie really drives home is that newer is not always better. And we as a culture worship technology, I think, and we enjoy it. It's fun and you know, we play video games or we use our phones and to deliver news or pay our bills. And it has made life more convenient. But in the case of medical devices or medical technology, newer sometimes is better or provides more information, but not always. I mean, so the one example in the film that is fairly controversial, and there's been this almost medical arms race amongst hospitals to procure these surgical robots. And it's not entirely clear. I mean, the marketing would say that these robots are much more successful. They are, for one thing, they're robots. We all sort of like the idea of a robot. It doesn't have human frailty. It can perform small, delicate procedures probably with a steadier hand. But the reality is something different about these robots. I mean, what did you come across in the documentary about these robots, surgical robots?
Well, the tragedy of the Da Vinci surgical robotic system is that the surgeons are not being properly trained, and the FDA does not require a minimum amount of training. They leave it up to the hospitals to make sure that their doctors feel that they're properly credentialed, and the manufacturer leaves it up to the surgeons to decide when they feel they are proficient enough. And they go for a weekend training, and they perform a few surgeries under the watchful eye of a proctor, and then they are cut loose to do these surgeries on their own, and with devastating results. You know, we have women in the film who were tragically injured because of the Da Vinci and because it was in the hands of someone who didn't necessarily know what they were doing. So, you know, technology is fantastic, and medical technology absolutely improves lives and absolutely saves lives. But we also need to be careful in our rush to embrace anything new, to see if it's proven, to see if it's being used in the best capacity. You know, Da Vinci was not the best choice for hysterectomy, and finally surgeons began realizing that, but it took a long time for the data to catch up, and many, many women were harmed in the interim.
So I want to just be clear on something. Is if the surgeon is properly trained or has had a number of robotic operations under his or her belt, do we think then, does the data support the use of the robot in certain cases, or is it really not, is it more of the robotic features as well as the surgeon's experience level?
The robot did have some flaws in itself. We didn't necessarily focus on some of the manufacturing flaws. Da Vinci has said that they have corrected most of those flaws. They had some cases of sparking. They had some cases of current that was escaping from the device and actually burning patients. We focused on the lack of training with Da Vinci. And I think under the proper guidance being used for surgeries where it's being known to do good, I think Da Vinci could be useful. But I think it's buyer beware. And I think anyone who is being promised da Vinci surgery is the best thing for them. They should have a conversation with their surgeon of how many of these surgeries have you done? What's your success rate? You know, how many patients have been harmed by you doing this surgery? What were the outcomes? And get all of that information before they have the surgery.
Yeah, and that can certainly be difficult for any of us to have that kind of conversation, which is why there's another recommendation at the end of the film about bringing an advocate, a family member or friend who can take notes and help you and ask questions and be an extra set of ears and eyes with any kind of medical encounter. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Amy Hurdy. She's producer of the new Netflix documentary, The Bleeding Edge, about America's medical device industry. And Amy, one of the features of the film is a look at the FDA. And there's a little bit of focus on Dr. Scott Gottlieb, who's the current FDA commissioner. And he has a strong, I guess you could say, background in industry. But you also show the last several FDA commissioners, all of whom have pretty strong ties, well, in industry, usually, I think, after they leave the FDA. So there's sort of this revolving door concept. What is it about Dr. Gottlieb that I think worried you as part of the filmmaking team, or, you know, what were the concerns there?
Well, Gottlieb came from industry and has strong ties to industry and has strong financial ties to industry. And so someone who's put in that position to oversee the FDA that's in charge of regulating industry is automatically put in a position where they have conflicts of interest. And we were not confident that he would be able to make the right choices and do the right thing by the American public. And I hope that we're proven wrong.
There was a line in the film about he did agree to recuse himself, I think, on any product that either he or his venture capital firm had invested in, but only for, was it 1 year or 2 years or something?
It would be 2 years under the ethics pledge that he had to take.
Right, and the ethics pledge, that always leaves me a little bit worried about how enforceable is that. But it was pretty striking to see the FDA commissioners who've gone on to essentially work for industry because, as the film points out, they certainly know how the approval process works, the ins and outs. Another area that the film looks at is radiology, and in particular, I guess, CAT scans. And this is sort of a minor aspect of the film, but the idea that the number of CAT scans ordered on patients has, I think, more than quadrupled. I mean, depending on what time frame you look at, I mean, we've gone from no CAT scans, I think, since before they were invented in sort of the 70s, to where they're so frequent and abundant in the United States, certainly in hospitals, but also in freestanding radiologic centers. And they've advanced so much that we're inadvertently causing, I think the film makes the claim, 50,000 cases of cancer a year just from radiation alone? Meaning
yes.
Just
and
these
that's
are just
not
diagnostic
the film
studies?
Claim. That is research that is backed up, and we cite the research that comes from. You know, Rebecca Smith-Feinman does amazing research, and she is in the process of winding up some of her clinical studies, and it's just tragic that the link between CT scans and their overuse and overexposure and cancer of Americans, and people don't know that information. And we could have made an entire film on CT scans alone. Often radiologists use a certain dosage for a patient and they don't adjust it for the next patient. So they may give a child the same dose of a CT scan that they just gave a 200-pound adult with devastating consequences. There's so much there about CT scans, but CT scans definitely are the cash cow of any ER operation and most hospitals. I mean, you know, they bring in income, so they're used very frequently, and they're a doctor's go-to diagnostic tool because, you know, doctors are worried about liability, and, you know, it's a very easy way to determine what exactly is wrong with the patient. But patients aren't informed to ask questions like, how much of a dose are you giving me? You know, are you giving me repeat doses? You know, and then, you know, how many doses have they had within, you know, a short amount of time? Often people who are in some type of a car accident, for example, undergo, you know, repeat CT scans over a period of several days. So there's all kinds of things inherently wrong with it. And we have two former FDA scientists who talked to us about the issue that when they brought their concerns forward about CT scans with several other FDA scientists, within 2 years, all of the scientists were either fired or let go.
Yeah, that was a haunting sequence in the film. And you mentioned Dr. Binman, who I think is on the faculty at the University of California, San Francisco. When she finishes this research or this, you know, and has made this claim that will be, I think, is in press or is going to be published about the 50,000 cases of cancer a year, what do you think may be the consequence? Will there be new guidelines issued or restrictions on how much radiation exposure one patient can undergo?
You know, I believe those guidelines are already out there. I just think that they're being enforced by anyone. I don't think there's a whole lot of awareness about what type of guidelines there are associated with CT scanning. So the information is out there, but industry has been slow to adopt it.
I want to shift gears here for a second and just ask you, Amy, about the film itself in terms of what was the inspiration for the film, or how did you and filmmaker Kirby Dick decide to tackle this subject, this complicated subject?
You know, this subject grew out of a random conversation that I had with someone over lunch. The woman was a nurse, Kathleen Bartholomew, an amazing person and a patient safety advocate. And she dropped a statistic that I thought was stunning, where she said, you know, medical mistakes kill hundreds of thousands of people every year. And I said, no. And I went home and started doing some research and found that, of course, she was accurate and it was spot on. And so I started talking to Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering and saying, this should be the next film. This is amazing. And at first, we were looking at the overall umbrella of medical harm, and we realized that we had to narrow it down. And we looked at all of the different aspects of it. And we said, okay, there's already an awareness about pharma. There's an awareness about hospital-acquired infections. But there's truly no awareness about medical devices and the fact that they are unregulated and this lack of awareness about the process of how they are approved. And so we decided to narrow our focus and make it strictly on medical devices.
Interesting. Well, I also, the last thing, just the film itself is beautifully crafted. I mean, a lot of times I was sort of shaking my head and thinking, wow, how did you get this footage, or how did people agree to these interviews? But there in particular were these, I guess you could call them file footage or old footage from public service announcements, essentially warning the general public about quack doctors and specifically about quack medical equipment or medical devices.
Quackery. Yes,
quackery.
That's all Kirby. He is so amazingly creative. His films are phenomenal. I remember saying to him several times along the way, I don't know how I just want to condense all of this into an hour and a half, because this could easily be, you know, a series of films. We had so much material, and to this day, I shake my head on how he was able to whittle it down.
Well, those old stock footage things were just so fascinating as a historical and cultural oddity, because it seems like we've completely flipped where we those were in the days before we regulated devices, and yet we were warning the public about quackery, and now we have devices that are, as you say, cleared, not necessarily approved, but cleared to go to market with very little in the way, if anything, in terms of scientific study. And, you know, barrage of marketing and advertising that is saying, go ahead, these are safe and effective, let's use them, you know, and then once there's some adverse effects, trying to, in a sense, punish or not believe the messengers, that is, the people that are harmed by these devices.
It's very much buyer beware in the medical device industry. As Jenny Linzer puts it, it's the wild, wild west.
Well, the name of the film is The Bleeding Edge. It is a newly released Netflix original documentary about the medical device industry. And Amy Hurdy, our guest today, is the producer of this film, and it's currently at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, so it's strongly recommended. Amy Hurdy, congratulations on the film, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.